Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Reverend Colin Bawson about his article, The Universalist Klansman. Essentially, what it boils down to is that it may surprise people that Unitarians and Universalists had amongst their ranks earlier in the 20th century people who also had some sort of affiliation or sympathy for the KKK. It's a fascinating article, so I got a hold of the Righteous Reverend, and he agreed to join us last week and this week as well. A little bit about Reverend Bawson. He is currently serving as the interim senior minister of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Houston. He has a PhD from Harvard, where he wrote his dissertation on the relationship between theology and populism. So we welcome once again to Common Threads, Colin Bawson. Hello, Colin.
Hey. So
last week, we talked quite a bit about the theology of the Unitarian Universalist Association. We talked about the history of both denominations that came together in the early 60s. I'd like to focus a little bit more today on the article itself, which again, as I said just a second ago, I found quite fascinating. And I'm assuming that it has probably surprised a lot of readers. In the article, you say that the KKK strove to unite both liberal and conservative strains of Christianity. Again, this is back in the early part of the 20th century. What part of their message, the message of the KKK, would you expect to find appeal among liberals of that age?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I want to be a little careful here on some level, because I think that there's a narrative that sort of goes around amongst some people today, some people on the right today, that the KKK, because it had an affiliation, affiliation is the wrong word, a number of Democratic politicians, prominent politicians who were part of it, was somehow means that the Democratic Party is, today is sort of a racist institution.
Yeah, I've heard that. I saw a debate on television between Van Jones and some vile person,
right,
who was trying to make the case that, yeah, our problem with racism today is due to liberals.
Right. So I think I want to be really careful about that, because I am going to say some things about the Klan that I think could be used by some people who want to make that argument. And so I want to be really careful that I think that that argument is not at all correct, that it is completely ahistorical and doesn't pay attention to the sort of development of American politics over the 20th century. And that actually, if you take the things that I'm going to say about the Klan right now seriously, they highlight some challenges, and I don't know if we can talk about this on your radio show, so you could stop me, but some particular challenges or dangers about the current president.
Nobody's going to stop you.
Okay, in particular ways that I think make who he is and what he's doing more troubling and more clear. So let me just sort of, having said that preface, I can't remember what that guy's name is, but I saw that that debate as well, that he was completely wrong. So having made that Van Jones was completely right in that argument. Having said that, the thing about the Klan that is really fascinating, so we're talking about the 1920s Klan, is that they self-identified as liberal. So they saw themselves as, they called themselves 100% American. And they said that being 100% American meant they claimed, now, what they actually did and what they said they were doing, we want to separate rhetoric from action. So I'm just talking about their rhetoric, not what they actually did, which is a different conversation. And we could get there in a minute. But in terms of what they said that they were for the public schools. They were for freedom of speech. They were for freedom of religion. They were for democracy. They were for these things that we think of as kind of liberal values or progressive values. They were for, many of them were for the right of women to vote, and were also in support of prohibition, which were sort of progressive values in the 19-teens and 20s. So, you know, that is important to highlight here. And it's also important to highlight that people like Woodrow Wilson, while maybe not actually Klansmen, certainly were either supportive or thought of by the Klan as kind of good politicians in many ways. Wilson is, there's a famous film called Birth of a Nation, which is a film celebrating the Ku Klux Klan of the Reconstruction era. And Wilson is supposed to have shown this film in the White House and is actually widely quoted in the film. This is back when it's a silent film, so there's film cards. So there's this strong relationship between, and Wilson is kind of one of the great progressive presidents, right? So there's a strong relationship at that moment between white supremacy and these kind of liberal values. That doesn't mean that, liberals are to blame for racism. In fact, what it suggests is how insidious and how deeply rooted white supremacy is in American society. Because, I mean, not necessarily the Klan, but like people who were identified as progressives in the 19-teens and 20s who are today people who would be very troubled by contemporary white supremacist movements, by the alt-right, and would be opposed to those things. But at the time, American society didn't have anywhere near the racial consciousness amongst people who imagined themselves to be white that we can find in some pockets today, right? Because before the civil rights movement, which is a watershed transformation of American society, the great African American intellectual W.E.B. Du Bois is not necessarily a central intellectual figure in a lot of discourse at that time, in the way that somebody like Cornel West or Barack Obama would be today. So it's a very different moment in American history, and it's a moment actually where, in a lot of ways, discrimination is getting worse. You have race riots where people who imagine themselves to be white are targeting and destroying communities of people of color. Famous one in Tulsa in 1921, famous one in East St. Louis in 1919, which are horrific. Hundreds of people are killed. Hundreds of people of color are killed by the white community. So it's a very endemic problem. The number of people who self-identify as white who have a kind of developed anti-racist consciousness is much smaller at that point than it is today. So the Klan promotes itself during those years as the purveyor of, they call it 100% Americanism, of these sort of values of free speech, of freedom of religion. And their sort of argument, so to speak, and their argument for white supremacy is that these ideas come out of European culture. They come out of Protestant European culture. No other culture in the world has come up with these ideas. And it's a totally ahistorical argument, but it is nonetheless their argument, right? No other culture in the world has come up with these ideas. No other culture in the world has come up with the Constitution of the United States or the Magna Carta or whatever. And so we need to be white supremacists because only by being white supremacists can we preserve these values of liberal democracy.
Were they actually using the term white supremacist? We need to be white supremacist, or did they have a kinder, they didn't have a kinder and gentler word for that, huh?
I mean, it depends on the person you're talking about, but certainly plenty of them self-identified as white supremacists. The guy that I write about in that article, was it Charles E. Clark? I haven't seen anything written by him where he explicitly identifies as a white supremacist. Instead, he really identifies with this 100% Americanism and these values of freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and that somehow America is uniquely poised or qualified or whatever, and European Americans are uniquely poised and qualified to push these views, and that's why his church, he claims, should support the Klan.
If they were supporting freedom of religion, then why did they have such issues with Catholics and Jews?
Right. Well, so it's not, you know, it's not a coherent worldview. And so their claim is that the Catholic Church is opposed to freedom of religion. And so therefore, in order to have freedom of religion, we need to be anti-Catholic, is their logic. Because they'll talk about papal tyranny and the papal plot to sort of take over the world. Romanism and the threat, the worldwide threat of Romanism. And so they say, freedom of religion is something that can happen as long as white Protestants remain in charge. So as soon as you let anybody else come into charge, we're going to all lose freedom of religion. So that's where, I mean, that's part of where their hatred of Catholics comes from.
Okay.
Or at least the argument for the hatred of Catholics comes from. And that's where their that's where their sort of deep racism and deep anti-immigrant sentiments come from, because they think that there's one Klan leader, he's a judge from Indiana called, what's his name, last name? His last name's Orbison. I'm trying to remember. I think his first, I can't remember his first name, but his last name is Orbison. And he talks about how the United States is the present utopia, the perfect society, and that in order to protect this perfect society, this perfect utopia, we need to be opposed to the Catholic Church because they're going to be against our freedom of religion, and we need to be opposed to immigrants because they're going to somehow dilute the racial purity that's necessary to have these great values of liberal democracy. I mean, it's a completely ridiculous argument, but this is where they're coming from, and it's how they sort of get to both being white supremacist and claiming to have these kinds of values around freedom of religion. And you know, it's clear to me that when they talk about freedom of religion, they mostly mean freedom of Protestantism, right? So that you could be a Baptist or a Methodist or a Presbyterian, rather than this idea that, you know, it's okay to be Hindu or Islamic, you know, be a Muslim or a Jew or something like that. But those are people that they have issues with. I mean, the Klan also talks, and I think it's complete BS, if you can excuse my language, about how they're the greatest friends of the Jews or great friends of the African-American communities, because they're going to, I mean, it's paternalism, right? They're going to be in charge, and by them being in charge, they're going to preserve this kind of society that will let these other groups flourish.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today, Reverend Colin Bawson. And we're talking about his article, The Universalist Klansman. So, yes, let's talk about this particular gentleman who was a Universalist and a Klansman, this Mr. Clark. Tell us about him and his influence on the congregations in Massachusetts.
Yeah, I mean, he's a pretty marginal figure, and I think that that's one thing that is important to recognize. So one thing I say in that article is that he's the only Universalist minister, and I haven't found a Unitarian minister who was a vocal supporter of the Klan or an actual Klan leader. He was not raised Universalist. He converted to Universalism, I believe, from Methodism. In like 1915, 1916, somewhere in there, served a couple of congregations very briefly in the South, and then was called to a church in Massachusetts, in Medford, Massachusetts, actually about right across the street from Tufts University. And when he was called there, he was certainly not open about his relationship with the Klan. I'm a little unclear as to how long he had a relationship with the Klan, just in terms of the existing historical record. He is a fairly successful parish minister in this in Medford, which is a sort of a suburb today of Boston. He grows the congregation, so people feel very fondly of him, or a lot of people think fondly of him. It's a time when religion, or when Christian churches are, some of them are going through contraction in the United States, so a time kind of like today, where there's a lot of hand-wringing about the future of the church. So he's a successful parish minister. He grows his church over the period of a few years. At some point, a year or two after he gets there, he starts organizing with the local Ku Klux Klan and holding meetings of the local Ku Klux Klan in his church. There is a bunch of the new people who join the church are affiliated with the Klan. Seems like they may have been trying to take over the church. And this, within about the space of a year, starts to spill out into kind of the public, right? So people become aware of it. There is debate in the Universalist National magazine around the relationship between Universalism and the Klan, with whether one can be a Universalist and a Klan leader. With most people saying, no, you cannot be a Universalist and being a Klan leader. But the editor of the journal giving, I think it's called the Universalist Leader at that time, giving Clark plenty of space to defend his views. And then there is a vote at his church whether or not to essentially get rid of him, although the actual issue is over something else. But basically the vote is to get whether or not he's going to be able to continue. And the what's called a district superintendent, but basically the, it's not really a bishop, but kind of the equivalent of a bishop, the ecclesiastical head of the local Universalists, comes and more or less supports Clark, saying he's done good things to grow this church. And so he has freedom of belief and freedom of pulpit, and so we should stand by him. Clark survives that vote, but within about 18 months is gone from the church and basically disappears from the denomination at that point. He becomes a Congregationalist, which is another denomination or religious tradition that is, for the most part, a very strong justice tradition. For a while, serves in a few Congregationalist churches in New England, and then retires, maybe 5-6 years after all of that. So he is in many ways a marginal figure. I think the thing that's interesting about him in some ways is just to show that we talked last week about how Unitarian Universalism, the historical institutions of Unitarian Universalism, come out of white communities or communities that imagine themselves to be white. And so he's sort of this interesting example of how this particular kind of extremist white supremacist thought was able to find this toehold within Universalism because people at the time had not done the work around, or many people had not done the work around anti-racism, around really interrogating the ways in which their communities, even though they have these wonderful values of universal love and of tolerance and religious pluralism, hadn't really done the work of thinking about how are the ways we're complicit with racism, complicit with these oppressive structures. And so if you don't do that work, even if you have these values, you can end up with somebody like Charles E. Clark as your minister for a little while. So I think that's pretty much what I have to say about Clark.
Well, another thing that I was going to mm-hmm. ask you is that I'm curious, this movement we're talking about, the time and place, it's 1920s and it's New England, mm-hmm. right? Now, I'm wondering if those people really understood the reign of terror that was going on in the Deep South. And if they did that affect how they thought about the Klan? Or maybe they just lived in blissful ignorance and thought that their brethren down south was doing the same kind of work, being these supposedly progressive 100% Americans.
Right. I mean, I think that most of them were in, I would say, willful ignorance rather than blissful ignorance of the Reign of Terror. I mean, then as now, if you are an upper middle income or above person who understands themselves to be white, you are insulated from a lot of the horrors of the world due to what people call white privilege. And a lot of people actually spend a lot of energy trying to ignore what is going on in the world. And I think that they, you know, at that time especially, if you were not in dialogue with the African, if you're a person who imagined themselves to be white, who's not in the dialogue with the African American community or in dialogue with the labor movement, you could easily be unaware of the sheer brutality of American society, right? I mean, the 19 teens and 20s are an absolutely brutal time in American history. Not only do you have these movements of, like, the Klan, of white supremacists that are going around, and there's a spike in lynching, and there's these horrible race riots that are going on, almost all of which are in the South, some of which we actually still don't even know the full details of because they were so poorly covered. I mean, there are small towns that had race riots where dozens of people are killed that historians are only now starting to know what happened there. And the same is true of the labor movement. I mean, the 19-teens and 20s are a time when the federal government is intentionally suppressing the radical, anti-racist, anti-capitalist labor union, the industrial workers of the world, where people in that movement, I mean, there's something like 200 to 250 people from that movement who are lynched or killed in prison by police officers or, you know, otherwise die for standing up for their beliefs. The government jail engages in the mass jailing of political dissidents during the end of World War One. So it's a really brutal time, and I think that anybody who is sort of promoting 100% Americanism either thinks, A, that all of those movements for justice are somehow threats to their 100% Americanism, which I think is quite a few of them, or they're just willfully blind to what's going on in the world around them. And I think that those two things are not mutually exclusive. You know, these kinds of movements are not rationally based discourses, right? I mean, you see this today when the current president is trying to stroke up enormous amount of fear about the need to build a wall, which, by the way, was a thing that the Klan suggested in the 1920s, along the border between the United States and Mexico. And border crossings are down. The number of migrants into the United States who don't conform to the sort of strict migration regimes that we have in place, you know, is down. And yet somehow this is, you know, a national emergency. He's trying to whip up all of this imagined fear that's not based in reality. It's not based in facts. So I think that we're closing in on the end of our time. And I think one thing that I really want to highlight before we go is the sort of similarities and differences between the current president and the historic Ku Klux Klan, because I think they're very important to understand. And so I think that I published an article in Huffington Post in January of 2016 called The Klan-like Rhetoric of Donald Trump. And in that piece, I really tried to highlight the ways in which President Trump speaks very similarly to Hiram Evans, who was the second Imperial Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. And I talk about how they both stoke up fears around migrants or immigrants, how they both target religious minorities in Trump's case, it's Muslims. In Hiram Evans' case, it was Catholics. How they both follow the logic of what's called an apocalyptic narrative. They sort of say that the world's at a point of crisis. If we don't do something about it, we're going to experience this great catastrophe. But if we do do something about it, we can have we can make America great again. We can re-Americanize America, is what Hiram Evans says. So there's a great number of similarities. And you can go find the article if you want to sort of see out where I'll trace them all out. Kelly Baker did a similar piece in The Atlantic a while ago as well. So if you want to see that sort of argument traced out, you can go look at that. But the thing that is troubling, particularly about Trump, is he invokes all of this rhetoric that is essentially very similar to the white supremacist rhetoric of somebody like Hiram Evans. But Evans and the Klan of the 19-teens and 20s really roots itself in the values of liberal democracy, right? So they talk about freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion, so on and so forth. And we've sort of talked about their gloss on that and how that's problematic, but they do think of themselves as advocates of a kind of rights-based liberalism. Trump does not. So you have the white supremacist talk. But the thing that's really different about him is he does not employ that frame of kind of liberal democracy, rights-based liberalism. One of the things that happens when we compare these two groups, the Klan of the 1920s and President Trump, is that you really see how they can both have these kind of similar white supremacist thoughts or patterns or rhetoric, but that Trump is very much illiberal and authoritarian as opposed to democratic in his orientation. And I think that that really highlights the kind of danger of the present moment that we
you won't get any argument on this side. We are down to the wire, Colin, but I really appreciate your insights and some just brilliant research that you've done on this subject. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and it was a pleasure to be with you. If you want to learn more about Unitarian Universalism, go check out UUA.org, which is the website of our association. You can find out information there, how to connect with a local Unitarian Universalist congregation.
Wonderful. Our guest today, Reverend Colin Bossin. He is the interim pastor at First Unitarian Universalist Church in Houston. I'm Fred Stella. This is Common Threads. You're listening to WGVU.